Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, a podcast about early American history with Liz Covart. The study of history is key to understanding who we are and how we can affect a better future. Ben Franklin's World will introduce you to historical people and events that have impacted and shaped our present-day world. And now, here's your host, Liz Covart.
Hello, and welcome to episode 46 of Ben Franklin's World, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn more about how the people and events of our early American past have shaped the present-day world we live in. What caused the American Revolution? Can we use the term American Revolution to describe the revolution and the war for independence? What was the greatest challenge that George Washington and his Continental Army faced during the war for independence? By listener request, today's episode features a conversation with John Furling, author of Whirlwind, The American Revolution and the War That Won It. I had so much fun conducting this interview, which I pursued because you asked me to. So thank you so much for pushing me to do this. And the reason I had so much fun is because my absolute favorite period in all of history is the American Revolution. And John is an expert. He has written 11 books on the subject. And not only is he an expert and a fan of the American Revolution like I am, he's also a big baseball fan. So this interview allowed me to talk about two areas I am passionate about, and this just made this interview so much fun for me to do. So thank you for your request. If you have any other requests for historians or topics, please send them along, because you're always right. I always have fun doing the interviews, and I also get to give you the topics that you're very interested in. John and I talked about a lot of different things, but here are some of the highlights. During our conversation, John reveals why he thinks the American Revolution happened, what colonists thought about if they made the decision to remain loyal to Great Britain or become a revolutionary, and details about the military aspect of the American Revolution, including casualty numbers for the war. Before we dive into our awesome conversation with John, I also wanted to take a moment to thank all of you who showed up for the first ever Ben Franklin's World Meetup. If you listen regularly, you know that that meetup happened on August 15th, and today is September 8th. But the reason I am delayed in thanking you is because I record these custom intros and outros 3 weeks in advance. And I do this because in January, I made a commitment to you. I promised you that I would provide a new conversation about history each and every week. Initially, I only worked 1 week ahead, and this winter, I almost had to break my promise to you. And I don't want to be in that position, and I don't want you to go without your weekly history fix. Now I work a bit ahead, so in case I get sick, my audio engineer gets sick or has a problem, or something else happens, you should still have an episode every Tuesday. Okay, now back to the meetup. I want to tell you all about it because it was a lot of fun. About 20 listeners came to Boston to meet each other and to commemorate the Sester Centennial, or 250th anniversary of the Boston Stamp Act riots. Together, we took a two-hour walking tour through Boston and discussed the riots and the role Boston played in the American Revolution. After the tour, six of us made our way to a pizzeria in Boston's North End, which is Boston's Little Italy, where we enjoyed lunch and lots of cold water, because while Mother Nature didn't rain on us, she made it really hot and muggy. Now, truthfully, I wasn't sure what to expect from this experiment, this meetup, but I was really pleased with the turnout, and I am so happy and so grateful that I got to meet some of you. This meetup was so much fun, I want to do it again, and I'm trying to think of more ways, different ways, that we can connect in person in the future. If you have an idea of how we can meet in person, please let me know, because you have so many good ideas, and I'm so grateful for them, and they're often better than my ideas, so please send your ideas along to me. Okay, are you ready for our awesome conversation with John Furling? Let's get to it.
With tidings and wisdom to share about our early American past, here is this week's special guest.
Our guest today is John Furling, an historian of the American Revolution and professor emeritus at the University of West Georgia. A dedicated baseball fan and historian, John has been known to schedule his research trips to Boston during baseball season just so he can catch games at Fenway Park. With the help of his cats, John has authored 13 books, 11 of which are about the Revolution and its leaders, including his most recent book, Whirlwind, the American Revolution, and the war that won it. Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, John.
Well, thank you for having me, Liz.
John, we are about to embark on an in-depth conversation about the political and military aspects of the American Revolution. But before we dive in, I am also a big baseball fan. I have been a Red Sox fan since I was a kid, which means I have to know, do you have a favorite Fenway Park moment?
Actually, the very first game that I ever saw there, I don't remember what year it was, probably around 1980 or thereabouts, but the Red Sox fell behind something like 4-0 and gradually chipped away. They were playing the Texas Rangers that night, and in the bottom half of the eighth inning, Carl Yastrzemski hit a grand slam home run that won the game for the Red Sox. And I never saw anything that surpassed that, I don't think. A lot of good games, but none that ever had a better ending than that one.
That's fantastic. And this year, they're celebrating the 1975 Red Sox. So Yaz was a part of that.
I think the first game I saw there was sometime after they won the pennant in 75. And so I did see a pennant-winning team a little bit later on, but not that team.
Thank you for sharing that memory with us. Now we should probably turn to the American Revolution. Let's start with the title of your book, Whirlwind: The American Revolution and the War That Won It. Now, many of us use the term American Revolution to describe the political and social movement and the war for independence. But your title implies that maybe we are incorrect to do so. Would you share your thoughts?
Sure. I hope that people don't get that impression from the title. I certainly think that there was a revolution and that the revolution did include political and social change. I interpret the word revolution to mean change and radical change at that. And I see the rundown toward independence, a long decade of protest against Great Britain, as a transforming time. It caused people to look at themselves, to look at America's relationship with Great Britain, to look at the nature of things in domestic America. And all of those things, I think, went together to sort of shape a notion of making changes. And out of that, I think, came republicanism and other changes as well. But when I used the subtitle, The War That Won It, I think the just simply declaring independence didn't make America independent. It had to be won, and that led to a years-long war to achieve independence. And the war, just like the insurgency in the 1760s and 70s, the war was transformative too. Thousands of people were wrenched away from home, forced into the military, or willingly went into the military, bore arms, made all kind of sacrifices, from getting shot at, wounded, killed, to paying taxes and doing without things. And that, I think, caused people to rethink a great many things. And the war, I think, was revolutionary in the sense that it obviously achieved independence, so that in place of 13 colonies, 13 independent states came into being. But it was revolutionary, too, in the sense that Great Britain was weakened. It lost colonies with which it had engaged in an enormous percentage of its commerce before the war. It led France into backing America with what we now know were consequences that led down to the French Revolution. So when I used the term in the subtitle, the American Revolution and the War That Won It, that's what I was thinking of, that both the insurgency and the war produced change, and certainly I do see change as part of the American Revolution. The main title in the book, of course, is Whirlwind, and I used that word in the title because it was a word that was used by both Abigail Adams and John Adams to describe these events that were swirling about them. In the case of Abigail Adams, in the first year of the war, first fall of the war, in the autumn of 1775 during the Siege of Boston, camp diseases spread from the siege lines out to communities around Boston, including Braintree, where she was living, and touched off epidemics, which led to the deaths of just innumerable civilians, including Abigail Adams's mother and a longtime servant in the Adams household. And in despair, she wrote to John that fall. He was in Philadelphia in the Continental Congress, and she wrote to John and asked, was it really worth it to touch off this whirlwind? And 6 months later, in the last weeks before independence was declared and the last final battles leading to the Declaration of Independence, John wrote back to Abigail in the spring of 1776, and he said, it takes courage to ride in this whirlwind. So I thought if both of them used the term whirlwind to describe what was going on around them, that was good enough for me. That captured their feelings about this American Revolution.
It's interesting that you brought up John Adams, because for me, your title evokes his quote, and I can't remember it precisely, but it's something like, the American Revolution took place long before the war.
Right, yeah. He said something to the effect, I can't remember it word for word either, but it was that the war had nothing to do with the American Revolution. And I think what Adams was saying was that the war had nothing to do with the protest against England. And of course, he was right about that, because the protest against England began 10 years before the war occurred. But I think he was wrong in saying that the war had nothing to do with the revolution, because the war, as I mentioned earlier, I think was a great radicalizing factor. It changed the outlook of many people toward Great Britain, and it caused people to look at themselves differently, to want different things in America. And so from my point of view, Adams was wrong in saying that the war had nothing to do with the revolution, because I see the revolution as going on after the war breaks out in April of 1775.
John's book, Whirlwind, does a great job of exploring both the political aspects and the military aspects of the event. I'd like to talk for a bit about the political aspects. If you study the American Revolution, you know that historians hold many different views as to why it happened. Some say it was a movement for a different social order. Others say it was a movement inspired by ideology, that the American Revolution occurred because Parliament violated age-old rights and principles the English Constitution had guaranteed to the British colonists. Still, other historians say that the revolution happened for purely economic reasons, that Parliament had no right to tax the colonists without their consent. John, why do you think the American Revolution happened?
Well, I think in a sense, there were probably as many reasons for a revolution as there were revolutionaries, that people came to support the insurgency and the revolution for a whole variety of reasons. But I think two factors were really paramount. One was a desire for American autonomy, that people wanted to control their own destiny. They wanted to determine who they traded with, for example. They wanted to determine on their own whether the West was going to be opened. They wanted certainly to determine when they went to war and when wars came to an end. And those decisions were made 3,000 miles away in England more often than not. So I think there was this desire on the part of Americans to shape their own future and their own destiny. And I think the longer the protest went on, the clearer it became to the colonists that they just would not have that right of choice as long as they remain part of the British Empire, that they would always be, in essence, seen as children rather than thinking adults by those who held power in London. But the other thing, and it was the thing that I probably emphasized at least as much, if not more, in the book, is I think economic factors were crucial in bringing about the American Revolution. I think merchants, particularly New England merchants and Southern planters who were exporting tobacco, wanted to be able to carry out their commerce free of British regulation and to ship their goods and buy goods wherever they pleased. People wanted to be able to move to the West, and they were prohibited from doing so by the proclamation of 1763. There's just a whole bevy, I think, of economic factors that moved people to begin thinking about breaking away and becoming independent. And in a sense, I think it's sort of captured by Thomas Paine in Common Sense, who painted a picture of independence as leading to a time of peace and prosperity. Peace in the sense that Americans would not be dragged into Britain's wars. As Franklin said in the last letter that he wrote before leaving London in 1775, we won't be dragged into wars by this old, rotten, plundering state any longer. But by being able to trade wherever they wanted to trade rather than where Britain wanted them to trade, there would be greater prosperity for Americans. And so I think the economic factor was really crucial in making people revolutionaries.
I have a question about how revolutionaries became revolutionaries. As you may know, in 1765, Parliament passed the Stamp Act as a way to generate revenue to help defray the costs of keeping 10,000 soldiers in North America after the French and Indian War. John notes that Bostonians and other colonists stood prepared to resist the Stamp Act, but they were not yet revolutionaries at this juncture. John, what made a colonist a revolutionary, and when did Bostonians and other colonists become revolutionaries?
Well, again, I think it's sort of like my answer to an earlier question that there may have been as many different explanations as there were revolutionaries. But again, by and large, I consider the word revolution to mean change, drastic change. And I think people gradually became revolutionaries once they decided that they just simply could no longer abide by British rule. They saw Great Britain as tyrannical. They saw a better future for colonists by escaping British control. And that was certainly a factor in making people revolutionaries. But also, I think there are those like Thomas Paine, like Jefferson, I think, who became revolutionaries not just because they saw the British as tyrannical, not only because they were protesting against British taxes or commercial regulation or whatever, but because they saw breaking away from England, gaining American independence, as the only way to bring about substantive change within domestic America. I think Jefferson wanted to restructure Virginia politics to give more people a say, to give, in effect, all free white men in Virginia a say in Virginia politics by enfranchising them. And by doing so, I think Jefferson envisaged a substantive change occurring, that more people would be formally educated, for example, more people would become landowners. People could chart out their own destiny, and they could never do that within the British Empire and under British jurisdiction. Paine, I think, saw the same thing occurring, that by breaking away from what he regarded as a tyrannical England, where power was monopolized by the crown and by a titled nobility, then by doing that, there was a possibility of, as Paine put it in Common Sense, starting the world anew. And he thought of the American Revolution and wrote of independence as the birthday of a new world. And so I think both Jefferson and Paine, they became revolutionaries not just to, as a result of their protest against England, but as part and parcel of bringing about substantive change within America. And I think in Paine's case, not just America, but he thought America was the first step. If America achieved independence and brought about sweeping reforms, it would have such an impact in England that it would trigger a British Revolution as well. I think Jefferson was a little slower in coming to that realization, but I think he got there in the course of the several years he spent as a diplomat in France in the 1780s. And in a sense, I think Paine and Jefferson really are become, out of this, they become, in effect, world revolutionaries, or at least they thought that the American Revolution might inspire revolutions throughout Europe and bring an end to monarchical rule and rule by titled nobility.
Revolutionaries wanted to change the governance of North America, and they decided that the best course for doing that was outside of the British Empire. But there were other American colonists who also wanted to effect change, but they thought that the best course to do that was within the British Empire. John, could you talk a little bit about the Loyalists?
Sure. The Loyalists, obviously, I always had to explain this to my classes because many thought Loyalists were those who were loyal to the American Revolution, but Loyalists was the term that historians use for what the revolutionaries called the Tories, and they were the people who remained loyal to England itself. Now, they were the most conservative of the colonists by and large, and they, although there were conservatives who certainly supported the American Revolution, like John Adams, most of the Tories were politically conservative. And I think they were fearful of any number of things. They feared that America could not win the war against Great Britain. After all, they would be fighting against a Great Britain that had the strongest navy in the world and a professional army and was a rich country, and America had very few resources with which to fight against a super power like that. And if they lost the war, Loyalists feared that there would be severe reprisals visited on America. But they also feared the social and political changes that might be unleashed in the course of a revolution. In the First Continental Congress, for example, one of the delegates within the Pennsylvania delegation was Joseph Galloway, who had been the Speaker of the House of the Pennsylvania Assembly for almost 20 years. And Galloway warned in a long speech of several hours to the Continental Congress in late September of 1774, that if we push a radical agenda and it leads to war and it sets off a sweeping revolution in America, the result will be social change. It will lead to egalitarianism. It will lead to democracy and whatever. And Galloway turned out to be, fortunately, I think, exactly right. His fears were borne out, and there was a social revolution and a political revolution that accompanied the American Revolution. So the Loyalists, I think, feared all of that. that. And of course, they feared the loss of their property as a result of sweeping democratic change in America.
I know we could talk about the politics of the American Revolution for days, but I do want to do justice to your book, which also covers the military aspects of the revolution. Let's begin by looking at the differences between the military tactics of the British Army and those employed by George Washington and his Continental Army. Would you tell us about the different military tactics these armies used?
Sure. The British followed the norm for European warfare that had been in place for a century or more. All of their tactics were sort of standard operating procedure with all of the European armies. The Americans, I think, had two choices in how to fight against the British. They could have waged a guerrilla war, or they too could have used conventional tactics. And from the very beginning, I think Congress wanted the Americans to use conventional tactics. So Washington agreed with that, and Washington tried to build an army that was pretty much modeled on the European army, and both sides wound up to a considerable degree using pretty much the same tactics, although at least at the outset. But Washington, I think, did something that not all leaders would do. Washington, I think, after the drubbing that he took in the New York campaign in the summer and fall of 1776, realized that he might not be able to win the war by trying to fight the British in an entirely conventional manner. And he told Congress he was going to have to switch over to what he called a war of posts, or what most military historians call a Fabian strategy. And that is that he would pick the time and place that he would fight. He would not risk his entire army in an engagement against the British. And so he was looking at a war of attrition that would go on for a long period of time, and that would eventually force the British to the peace table and to make the concessions that the Americans were demanding. Washington did not always adhere to a Fabian strategy, but he did certainly at times, and the best example is in the Trenton-Princeton campaign at the end of 76 and 77, which was, I think, one of the most brilliant military campaigns ever waged by an American commander. And it was replicated by General Nathanael Greene in 1781 in the Southern Theater with just equally good results.
The adoption of Fabian tactics doesn't mean that the soldiers were running away from the field of battle, does it? It just means that they were avoiding conflict if they could avoid it.
Right. To pick the best time for going into combat. For example, when Washington decided to make the strike at Trenton, he picked a post that was occupied by about 1,500 Hessian or German mercenaries that were under the British control. And Washington had somewhere in the neighborhood of about 5,000 men, so he had numerical superiority. He struck on Christmas night, so it was a surprise attack. And it did catch the Hessians by surprise and led to the killing or capture of about 1,000 of the enemy troops. But no, it didn't mean that the Americans would run away, but it did mean that the Americans at times would have to withdraw. And in fact, Trenton and Princeton were preceded by Washington's retreat across New Jersey and across the Delaware River into what was more or less a sanctuary of Pennsylvania during December of 1776. So it was always with the eye of Washington picking the time and place to fight and not permitting the British to make that decision for him.
It seems like Washington made a wise decision to go with these Fabian tactics, because in the end, the Americans and the Allied forces win the war. But I do wonder, what was the cost of this victory? How many men died during the War for Independence?
Yeah, I think the many people don't really understand how costly the Revolutionary War was. We don't have motion pictures of the fighting and the Revolutionary War. For the most part, our view of the war comes from looking at paintings that were made, and they conveyed something of a, I guess what I might call a sanitized version of things. But it was tough going in the war. The soldiers experienced, as I think most people are aware, considerable deprivation. They didn't have adequate clothing oftentimes, didn't have adequate blankets, didn't have adequate shelter. They were without food and sometimes subsisted on really a poor diet that wasn't nutritious. And in the long run, lots and lots of people died. There were about 100,000 men served in the Continental Army during the course of the war, between 1775 and 1783. And by conservative estimates, about 25,000 of the 100,000, about one-fourth, perished during the war. And that's conservative estimates. Many historians feel that the death toll probably exceeded 30,000 out of the 100,000. And that's only men who served in the Continental Army. Every state had militias, and the militiamen were called up to duty from time to time to augment the Continental Army. Many of the militiamen saw action as well. And the records are pretty good for the Continental Army, not complete, but pretty good for the Continental Army. But many of the records for the militia have just disappeared. And so one can only wonder how many militiamen were killed. So, but even excluding the militiamen, because we would have to guess at the death toll there, and just looking at probably a realistic figure of about 30,000 who served in the Continental Army perishing, and they perished, by the way, in battle. They perished from camp diseases, and many of those who died were prisoners of war who died while in captivity. But if we just take that figure of 30,000 men, which I think is a realistic figure, then the percentage, not the number, but the percentage of regulars who served and died during this war is just about the equivalent of the percentage of regulars in the Confederate and Union armies who perished in the Civil War. So I think everybody sees the Civil War as being a real bloodbath. But from that standpoint, looking at it on a percentile basis, the Revolutionary War was just about the equivalent of the Civil War. And a far, far greater number of men who served perished than was true of the men who served in the American Armed Forces during World War II.
And of course, to this figure, we must add a civilian death toll. I know in New York, there were all sorts of Native American and Loyalist raids, and men, women, and children all died during them. And again, we probably don't have statistics to add, but those deaths happened.
That's right. The British are making raids on coastal towns from time to time. They're coming into Virginia and along the coast in New England and in New York and making raids. They're arming the Native Americans who are making attacks in places like the Mohawk Valley, for example, in New York. And so there were an enormous number of civilian casualties from those attacks, but then also soldiers would pick up camp diseases in the military, and then they would come home. In the first 2 years of the war, men served for only 1 year. And so at the end of that year, most of the men left the Army and they went home. And even later on, many of the men were furloughed and would go home for maybe 6 weeks or so, and then they would come back. This was during when the armies were in winter quarters. And so many of the soldiers took diseases home, and those diseases spread to the civilian sector. And it was a two-way street. Many soldiers brought diseases from the civilian sector back to army camps and transmitted those diseases to their comrades. So it was a very costly war, and costly for our enemies too. Perhaps as many as 70,000 British, French, Spanish soldiers died in the course of this war, because it was a world war. It wasn't fought just here, but there was fighting in the Caribbean. There was fighting over on the subcontinent, a little bit of fighting, a couple of small engagements in Africa. Even so, people were in those armies in a war touched off by the American Revolution were perishing as well.
You've mentioned that the Continental Army and its soldiers faced many challenges. I'm curious, what do you think the greatest challenge that George Washington and his armies faced was? Was it the undisciplined troops, the lack of supplies, disease, freezing winters, mutinies? What was the greatest challenge for the army?
Well, I'm tempted to say it was all of the above. Washington faced, I think, just enormous challenges, and he faced different challenges at different times during the war. For example, when in the first year of the war, Washington's greatest challenge was not getting enough men. He had plenty of men, but he had almost no munitions. He literally was telling Congress that the men had just a few rounds of munitions. We weren't making munitions in this country, and so they had to be obtained elsewhere. And fortunately for Washington, he was commander of the Continental Army for about 13 months before he really got involved in his first major engagement, and that was in New York. And by then, the munitions problem had been solved. And I think a second problem for Washington right at the beginning, and this was a problem that he realized that Congress, I think, wanted this done and probably made it clear to Washington when it appointed Washington, and he left Philadelphia and went to Boston to take command, knowing that he needed to do this, that the view was, and probably an accurate view, was that the army that existed there, the so-called Grand American Army that really consisted of just men from the four New England colonies who were besieging Boston, that was an army without discipline, and that many of the officers were political appointees. So that Washington had to, as the term went in the 18th century, new model the army. He had to reform the army, which led to breaking a number of officers, elevating other officers, finding other officers. And again, he was able to do this because there was no fighting during the first year that he was in command. And another problem that Washington recognized right off the bat was, as I mentioned earlier, initially Congress set the term of enlistments at 1 year. And they didn't want a longer term of enlistments because it feared standing armies. And it thought if you brought men in and they served for the duration of the war, this would be a standing army. And too often in history, standing armies had been used as a means of establishing dictatorships and tyrannies. And Washington, from the very beginning, told Congress, look, we can't fight this war with 1 year soldiers. In fact, at the end of the first year, most of the soldiers went home, and at the end of the second year, most of the soldiers went home, and new armies had to be recruited. But In addition to that, Washington, I think, told Congress it takes a long time to make a soldier out of a civilian. You have to break his civilian habits. You have to acclimate him to the military. You have to make him willing to take orders from officers and stand courageously on the battlefield under fire. And Washington finally went to John Adams in the fall of 76, and Adams was persuaded by then that only long-term enlistments would do the trick. And so for the army that was recruited beginning in 1777, men came in and served for 3 years or the duration. And starting in 77, Washington found himself confronted by another problem. The economy began to collapse. And by 1778 and 79, it had utterly collapsed. James Lovell, a congressman from Massachusetts, said at the beginning of 1781, "We are bankrupt." And he could have said that as early as 1779. So Washington faced that problem as well. And in 1779, I think Washington, because of the economy, saw another problem. Washington was not an economist. He had no experience in dealing with anything like this. And Washington's initial reaction was that the economic woes were the result of poor leadership in Congress. And as he looked around in Congress in 1779, he noticed that all of the great congressmen, in fact, virtually all of the congressmen, but certainly all of the leading congressmen from 1775, when he had been in Congress, were gone. Benjamin Franklin, John Adams were abroad serving as diplomats, and Jefferson was back in Virginia serving in the Virginia Assembly and seeking those reforms that I mentioned earlier that he wanted. And so Washington beseeched Jefferson and others to serve at the national level and tried to convince them and that great leaders, strong men, were required in the councils at the national level. And finally, I think Washington faced an enormous problem in the last couple of years of the war with morale. No one envisioned this war going on this long when the war began in 1775. But by 1780, the war's 5 years old, and people are tired of it. They've paid taxes. They've lost loved ones. They've done without in any number of ways. And morale was really breaking down in the country by that time period. And so I think Washington and everybody who was involved in pursuing the revolution and trying to win this war faced an enormous challenge in with just a war weariness on the home front. So all of those things were problems that he faced, in addition to the ones that you mentioned, the deprivation faced by the soldiers and whatever. When the war was coming to an end in 1783, and Washington was at West Point with his army, and he was just waiting to march down to New York when he learned that the British were finally going to evacuate New York City. When Washington finally got the word that the British were going to leave, and he was about ready to leave West Point, he issued a sort of a farewell address. Washington was very big on farewell addresses, and he issued a farewell address to his army. And in that farewell address, Washington said that the American victory was little short of a miracle. And I think that hit the nail on the head. I mean, if General Washington was somewhat surprised that a victory had been won, then I think probably historians should be aware of just how difficult it was to have won that victory.
John, before we transition into the time warp, I have to know, throughout Whirlwind, you cite the correspondence of Thomas Gage, William Howe, and Henry Clinton, the British commanders-in-chief who served in North America during the War for Independence. In many of these letters, the generals beseeched Parliament and the War Department to send more men. Do you think Great Britain ever fully committed to the military aspect of its war effort?
Well, not in time, and I think that was one of the great mistakes that the British made. General Thomas Gage was the commander of the British Army in the 1760s after the French and Indian War, and was still in command when the Revolutionary War breaks out. He's the one that gives the order for men to go to Concord to take that arsenal on April 19th of 1775. But in the late 1760s, 1768, I think it was, Gage wrote home, and he, on a number of occasions, and he tells the British this is a widespread rebellion, probably can only be put down by the use of force. And he says in one way or another in many of his letters that if force is going to be used, the British need to have a large army in America. It's imperative that the first battle be successful. And because that first battle, if they could score a stupendous victory over the Americans, it could break the back of the rebellion at the very beginning. And the British really didn't listen. They only had a small army, about 7,000 men in America. They were kind of scattered around. They had a bit more than 5,000 or so in Boston at the time that the order comes to use force to suppress the rebellion. And they just didn't have enough to score any kind of substantive victory in the fashion that Gage was talking about. And it's only, I think, when the British learn of the disaster on the day of Lexington and Concord, and then a few weeks later learn of a second disaster at Bunker Hill, that the Lord North's ministry begins to send really adequate numbers over to America. And really, I think the British had adequate numbers here, both in terms of an adequate navy and an adequate size army to have scored a consequential victory in the campaign in New York. But they had poor generalship, and they just didn't pull it off. But General Howe, I think, had the means, scoring a victory that, again, might have broken the back of the rebellion in 1776. But he let Washington wiggle out of one trap after another and have another day to fight. And that's when Washington went over to his Fabian strategy.
Let's transition to the time warp. This is a fun segment of the show where we ask you a hypothetical history question about what might have happened if something had occurred differently, or if someone had acted differently.
The time warp. Historians can't predict the future, but they can speculate about what might have been.
Right after Richard Henry Lee proposed that these colonies ought to be free and independent states, Lee proposed that Congress form a committee to draft a plan for a new central government. We know this plan of government as the Articles of Confederation, and one of the reasons Congress created a new central government was to demonstrate to Europe that the 13 colonies were in fact formally united as one nation. John, in your opinion, would France, the Netherlands, and Spain have supported the United States in its war for independence if the Continental Congress had not drafted the Articles of Confederation?
Well, I think France would have and did. I mean, in the sense that the articles were drafted and sent out to the states in 1777, but they weren't ratified until 1781. And France was actually clandestinely furnishing arms to the Americans before the articles even went out for ratification, and formed a treaty of alliance with the Americans before the articles were ratified. I think the main things, as far as the French were concerned, were, first of all, were the Americans really unified? And I think the fact that the Continental Congress existed and that there were men from each of the 13 states or colonies in the Continental Army. That was crucial as far as France was concerned. You know, they knew America couldn't win the war if it wasn't unified, and America had, at that stage of the war, managed to establish unity. And the other thing I think that was really crucial for the French was the leadership of the army. And the French were impressed by Washington in 76 and again in 1777. In 76 was Trenton, Princeton. And the French overlooked, I think, or ignored the many mistakes that Washington made in the campaign in New York and focused instead on Washington's daring in taking his army back across the Delaware River on two occasions in December of 76 to fight against the British. And then he again, in 1777, acted with great daring in attacking the British at Germantown outside of Philadelphia in October of 1777. And in fact, John Adams was in France at the time that the news came over, and Adams wrote back and said that Washington was a better diplomat than the diplomats that the U.S. had actually sent overseas. And what Adams meant was that it was Washington had persuaded the French that it could come into the war and back the Americans because the Americans were led by a good and daring commander.
John, you've written 11 books about the American Revolution. Is there a 12th book in your future? Are you going for a dozen books on the American Revolution?
Well, I am working on a book. I have a contract for a book with Bloomsbury again, and I've been at work on the book for about 14 months now. I started working on it when I took a couple of weeks off for R&R after the manuscript for Whirlwind was submitted. And it's a book on Jefferson and Thomas Paine. And I'm trying to look at the shaping of their ideas, what led them down the road to become revolutionaries, what it was that they wanted out of a revolution. The two men knew one another. They weren't in one another's presence very often, but they probably were in Philadelphia in 75 and 76 anyway, and they certainly were when Jefferson was in Paris and Thomas Paine was also in Paris. And we know that Paine called on Jefferson there at the American Legation. And so I'm trying to look at where they went, and I see both of them as world revolutionaries, as I mentioned earlier on in the conversation, that they both supported the French Revolution and hoped for sweeping revolution in Europe. And then both ultimately, things happen that lead them to despair for the French Revolution. So that's what I'm working on now, and hope to have the manuscript wrapped up and in my editor's hands in probably about a year.
Is there a place we can go to find out more information about you, your Jefferson and Paine book, and how we can get in contact with you if we have any questions?
Sure. Yeah, I have a website, and it's just johnferling.com, or you can just Google John Ferling, and it comes up as something like home or homepage. And it's a website that includes information on me and my books, and also includes the reviews of my book and podcasts. And there's a place on the website that any individual can use to write to me through that website.
John, thank you for this whirlwind discussion about the American Revolution. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, I did too, and I want to thank you again for having me on today.
When we discuss the American Revolution, many of us focus the conversation on either the political aspect of it or the military aspect. What I found so refreshing about our conversation with John is that we had the opportunity to talk about both facets of the revolution together. We talked about so much today, and yet we only touched the surface of the information in John's very readable and surprisingly not so thick book, Whirlwind. If you were looking for a book that provides a detailed overview about both the political and the military aspects of the American Revolution, you should seek this book out. You can find more information about John, his book, Whirlwind, plus everything we talked about today on the show notes page for this episode, benfranklinsworld.com/046. We didn't get a chance to talk about it during our interview, but if you were curious about my favorite Fenway Park moment, I think it has to be attending Game 2 of the 2004 World Series. Tim and I were fortunate to attend Game 6 of the 2013 World Series, which is when the Red Sox clinched their first title at home since 1918. But being able to be part, or at least feel like we were a part, of that 2004 championship season was just so very special. We've had a lot of great moments at Fenway Park, including the fact that Tim proposed to me on the Green Monster during a Red Sox-Yankee game. But I think even if you asked Tim, he would say that going to Game 2 of the 2004 World Series was our absolute favorite moment. As you know, I like to end every episode with a question. And this week, I would like for you to tell me what aspect of the American Revolution most fascinates you. Send your answers to me via liz@benfranklinsworld.com. Leave a comment on the show notes page for this episode or in Poor Richard's Club, our private Facebook community for Ben Franklin's World listeners on Facebook, or tweet me at Liz Covart. And if you're not yet a member of Poor Richard's Club, please consider joining. You can gain access to the club by texting BF World to 33444.
And remember, never leave till tomorrow that which you can do today.